Every time we showed up to interview Marjorie Diehl, the first minute was her yelling at us. She would scream at us, yell obscenities at us. Why are you guys here? Jerry would always compliment her at some point and say, Marge, you look really good today. And she would calm right down. And she would calm down and say, thank you, Jerry. And, you know, how can I help you guys today?
The way that I knew Bill was he was the best man in an in-law's wedding. A bit of a eccentric, a little bit of a character. Thinks he's smarter than the average guy, but, you know, that's Bill.
And you're afraid of Marjorie, right?
Awesome.
Yes.
Awesome.
She is extremely intelligent.
She is.
Manipulates people. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You know what manic depressives are?
Yes.
That's what she is.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst, New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
And again, we have two very special, extremely interesting guests, and they are...
Trey Borzaleri, executive producer and co-director of Evil Genius.
And Barbara Schroeder, writer and director of Evil Genius, the true story of America's most diabolical bank heist, streaming now on Netflix.
Say your name again, Trey. I love your surname.
It's Trey Borzaleri.
No, it's not.
Okay, it's Trey Borzaleri.
Borzaleri. Consiglieri.
There you go.
Italiano.
There you go. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming back, because we and our listeners have so many questions that we want to ask you about your experiences with these, quote, evil geniuses. So when we last left, we were talking a little bit about your when you got started and sort of the psychopathy and psychology of Marjorie and maybe even Bill Rothstein. So I think we did talk about Marjorie, but what about Bill? What did you think about him? I mean, obviously, he wanted to be known as the most intelligent person in the room, wherever he was, right?
Right, the smartest guy in the room, as he told FBI agent Jerry Clark when he sat down with him, you know, the night of the frozen body discovery. But you tried to meet him in person, Trey?
Yeah, I went to his house. It was totally bizarre. It was, you know, on many levels. You know, for me, first, it was, you know, researching this case and you know, it, like we all do, we get interested in something and then we become an instant expert via the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then you get a crazy idea. I'm going to drive to this person's house who had a body there not too long ago and show up at his door thinking that that was a sane thing to do, where, you know, it couldn't have been more. It's like, you know, two separate worlds colliding right
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Was there not a little voice in your head at any point saying... This may not be a safe thing to do at this stage.
The innocence of citizen journalists, thank God.
Yeah, and but it was helped. It was aided by the fact that the FBI said that he wasn't connected. So I'm thinking, right, he's going to want to talk. He's going to want to talk. And so, you know, you see it in the documentary. You see, you know, I'm literally across the street looking through the viewfinder. And there's a moment where it's like, well, wait a minute here. I've been looking through this viewfinder for like 5 minutes and he hasn't left the car. So or the van. He never got out. So I'm thinking, okay, well, I decided to drive over and I assumed at that point he had gone inside. So I walked up to the front door, knocked. No one came. And then I turn around and he's sitting in the van still staring right at me. You know, I almost, you know. So I ran back to the truck, you know, that I had. And I, you know, sort of kind of hid in there for a few moments until I could gather the nerve to approach him at the window.
So this is an interesting stylistic question I want to ask you, because a lot of documentarians fall into different schools of thought, fly on the wall, but you actually put the fly in the film. I mean, did you intend for it to you always to be in it, or did you tend to document it from a more, you know, observing her from afar, or?
Well, I would say from the start, you know, the idea was there for me, you know, to capture it that way, because I could tell, you know, early on that a little bit of what I was doing was unique. At least it was unique to me. I didn't have the resources to start covering myself following it. But then later, quickly, people started to become interested in why I was doing this. And especially people in the business, because there was really, this was no way to do a documentary.
you know, which I learned later. You know, no one would have done this. You know, that was too naive. The only reason, naivete is the only way that, you know, I embarked on this. But as things grew, you know, there was a point, actually, you know, really I was strongly considering not being in the piece, you know, when I reached out to Barbara in 2013. And
we tried that iteration, but then it became really obvious that you cannot tell the story. Trey's journey is the most interesting part of the story.
Right.
The fact that he and his persistence and his conversations with Marjorie. But we did want to use it strategically. So you hear Trey's voice as a narrator and then you wind him into the story. And we thought that was a good way of here's the story. Understand and experience the story as Trey did. And now let's go on Trey's journey with him to elevate this. Because when Trey brought the story to me, I didn't want to do another, you know, just another story that had a, you know, criminal and a horrible crime, and weird suspects. But Trey's involvement elevated the story and made it like another film that I had done. There was something special about it. I made a movie called Tall Hot Blonde about, there's a spoiler if I tell you what it's about, but it involves a very tricky person. And that too was an elevated crime story. And when Trey brought this to me and I started, I had so many wait what moments. He would say, well, this happened. And then there was another pizza guy who died. And then Bill Rossi, and I went to his house. I'm like, wait, what? So that was very, I wanted to tell his story.
Right.
And, can you just talk us through the relationship? So at what point, Trey, did you decide you're going to, you know, take it to Barbara? And how did you two first meet? And can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, Barbara had come recommended to me by numerous people. And so, you know, I didn't reach out to her initially. I kind of held. I was kind of, you know, waiting to see kind of where the case was leading, even though that everything was pretty much done. The trial, Marjorie's trial, was over. But eventually, you know, I ended up calling Barbara because I wanted to dig deeper into the case. And I've, you know, had been going alone for so long that, you know, bringing on someone that had been so highly recommended to me, you know, I thought only it could be an asset. And so, you know, Barbara was very interested and thankfully, you know, God bless her for joining me in this endeavor. And so we started working closely together, you know, from the start and did that until the end. You know, it was 5 years together. You know, and I would say that, you know, anybody embarking on a true crime case, you know, to have somebody like Barbara.
Oh, thanks, Trey.
Yeah, I mean,
she's a special weapon.
I have to just say, Jim and Laura have heard me say this a million times, and then I'll shut up. You know, in the age of reality TV, sometimes that gets conflated with the art of documentary, and it drives me insane when it does that, because people think, oh, you're in it for the money. And it's like, believe me, if you want to make money, do not go into documentary film. And just, you know, most of the documentarians I know toil in obscurity, make almost no money, and are in it for such a long haul. And so I guess it's like, what kept you going? And when did you know it was over? When did you know that you had it? Because I'm sure you could have ended it any number of times.
Right. Well, you know, it's true. You know, it was like every time, you know, believe me, everybody in my whole universe was saying, when is this going to be over? When are you going to stop? When is it going to be done? You can't hold on to it forever.
I mean, you had children while we worked together.
And my life changed so many different ways. But
they think that you were quite obsessive about it? Or?
Well, to be honest, people were really excited and supportive initially. But, you know, it became a real, you know, dirty topic amongst my family and friends because of, you know, how long it was taking. But to be honest, I would say, and you guys will agree in for different reasons, but, you know, this is the case that just keeps giving, you know, in terms of from my point of view or from a, you know, documentarian's point of view, the story kept growing. You know, even now we're getting into deeper levels of conversation. We're, you know, reevaluating Brian Wells's culpability here. Hopefully, you know, there's even a chance at bringing further justice these years later. So, you know, in the early stages, there were something would pop up on the horizon that made, you know, that was like another carrot that I was chasing. And so, you know, at first that was, you know, began with Marjorie, and then it began, you know, there was, could there possibly be charges, you know, and so it took years for that. And then there were indictments. And, you know, that was the first time that, you know, I was officially, you know, that Ken Barnes had been, you know, mentioned in the case publicly. Marjorie was referring to him the whole time that we were communicating, but just referring to him as a different person. and then the revelation of Jessica, you know, and that was a huge carrot for me.
And to your question about when we knew it was done and done in this iteration, because we are still chasing some of the unanswered questions, Trey, we both went to Erie several times, and Trey came back, and he had been keeping in touch with Jessica. The Jessica Hoopsick, who was the sex worker slash Brian's favorite yes. prostitute. And he came back from the trip. He said, Barbara, I need to tell you something. She said something to me, and he came over. We sit in the office, and he sat down, and he said, she says that Brian is totally innocent. And he told me her revelations, and my jaw dropped, and I said, that's the moment when I felt, now we have something that we can end this series on.
Mm. Interesting.
And that took 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years in the making to get to that point. And that was when, for me, you know, as I mentioned before, once you take that piece of information and insert it, then everything made sense to me, finally. So that was when I felt like, you know, a part of this, a chapter is closed, and we can, as Barbara said, really...
But you're still following leads now, did you say, Barbara? So it's still not ended.
I still want to know who wrote those notes.
That was going to be a question
to you. I still
want to
know who made those, who decided to make the bomb live. Who was the person who said, oh, no, let's just make it live.
Like, did you?
It's so evil.
Did you ever compare Marjorie's many letters to you to the bomb letters to see? You're looking at me like, yes, I did. Of course I did.
And did you bring in experts to do that?
We did. We brought in a handwriting expert, and he unequivocally thought that Bill Rothstein wrote those notes. There was one that had some squiggly writing on it, and he thought maybe somebody else helped with that. But, you know, that was astonishing that they weren't able to get more information from those notes, because there were some specific, you know, idiosyncrasies in there and some misspellings that maybe they misspelled on purpose to throw people off the track.
You really should have Jim Fitzgerald look at them from a linguistic perspective, because he doesn't look at handwriting. He looks at the content, you know, how this person learned to read and write and where their influences are from. And there's so much material here that I'm sure he's going to find a number of things that everybody else just glances right over. I really think that would be fascinating to pursue that.
And here's some insider information. There was an investigator who worked for America's Most Wanted, Joe Matthews, who was tracking down some of the notes. And he found one of the Bill Rothstein's roommate, Floyd Stockton's. He found one of that Floyd Stockton's ex-wives and interviewed her. And had we been able to do more of a deep dive, if we had more episodes, we would have gone into this deeper. But she revealed to this detective, she said, you know what, those little equal signs that show up in between numbers and that were on the bomb, she says, I have dozens of letters from Floyd. That was one of his things. And wow. I always wondered, like, there are little drawings on there. Did the FBI profilers or the ATF, whoever was analyzing the letters, did they have all the suspects draw something to see? Like, did they draw the McDonald's? Right. Could they draw, not that they necessarily would have produced that on the spot, but so this ex-wife was convinced that those were Floyd Stockton's notes, that those were his, that he had something to do with it.
And of course, Floyd Stockton received immunity, didn't he? And he's still, you know, based on his version.
I cannot say this more clearly. The man who latched the collar around Brian Wells' neck got complete immunity.
That's right. And not only that, he's a child molester and is out walking free right now.
To this
it's
day.
Disgusting.
It really is. And it just tells you that there needs to be some more consistency in how these kinds of cases are actually addressed. Because, you know, even though they called themselves geniuses, these people made bonehead mistakes. They left so much evidence. And they did a horrific job. Actually, there is no way for this crime to have happened the way it was supposedly planned.
Yeah, was the motive bank robbery, or was it to kill somebody? And for Bill Rothstein to have a swan song and show the world that who never believed he was special or important and was a loser, was this Bill Rothstein's swan song to show
his
the world
legacy.
That he was somebody? Or was it Marjorie Dale Armstrong who got involved and became one of the cogs in the wheel and propelled everything forward with her money and with her need to get... It's endlessly fascinating.
A few weeks after Marjorie asked the FBI to move her to a prison closer to Erie, they actually arranged for a transfer, anticipating she'd provide new information about the heist. But she didn't. She just kept implicating Bill Rothstein.
What did you make of Bill Rothstein's suicide note? You know, and just that sequence of, wasn't it 3 weeks later he calls up about, you know, Jim Roden's body, and, you know, is that just happenstance? Did he know about Marjorie's background of her claiming self-defense and obviously, you know, being acquitted at court of the murder of her previous partner, which was in the 80s?
Yeah.
What did you make of that and piecing that together?
Yeah, again, you know, it's just a fascinating launching point into another conversation, in the sense that if he hadn't made that phone call, they would have walked. You know, they could have all walked from this whole thing.
Right.
And so when you think of it in that, with that regard, you know, it's like, look, we can say a lot of bad things about Bill Rothstein, but there's no proof that he killed someone else prior to Brian Wells. And so, you know, this was a class clown. This was a, you know, in essence, a spoiled kid, you know, coming from a very, very wealthy family.
His parents ran the Rolla Cola bottling company in town. He was a prince of Erie. Yeah.
Yeah. And so his little plan up until that phone call had worked, and he could have kept going, but he collapsed, I believe, under the gravity of what he had actually done. You know how you do something sometimes and then you're like, oh God, why did I do that? I can't handle what that actually represents. And he was afraid of her also.
But do you believe that, Trey? I mean, you know, there's also a thing with psychopathy, and Jim would talk to this, you know, where they like to be in the eye of the storm. You know, that they will insert themselves in the investigation. And you'd think, well, why would they do that? But it's because they think that they are too smart, you know, in some senses, that actually they're one step ahead. But of course, it can be the thing that becomes their downfall. And that's where, again, you know, on the kind of the day-to-day, the tactical stuff, you know, psychopaths can be okay in their decision-making, but the strategic stuff of how it all fits together tends to be the thing that catches them out. And for me, that bit of insight where he's being interviewed by the FBI, was it the FBI investigator
Jerry, FBI, yeah.
And he says, you know, that he wants to be known as the smartest guy in the room, and that is real insight to Bill Rothstein, then showing them around his house and kind of treating it. So those little moments for me, the fact that he calls up, is it because he doesn't feel he's getting enough, you know, attention for what they've done?
That might be, but think we have to give you some more information on what was happening right before Bill called in that frozen body.
Yeah, go ahead.
He and Marjorie was just, you better get him buried. You better get him out of the freezer, because she wanted her boyfriend buried. And Bill had put him in the freezer, initially unbeknownst to her. Marjorie didn't find out he was in the freezer right away.
Where did she think he was?
She had told Bill. Bill had promised her he would take care of it. They had talked about a lot of different ways. They were going to grind the body up. They were going to throw it in the Allegheny River. And he basically said to her.
This is according to Bill, is it? Yes. This is Bill's version.
I mean, it's.
Let's just be clear on what he's saying.
The facts.
Marjorie's
version.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that she didn't know right away. Bill was just taking care of it for her. He said, don't worry about it. And for some reason, this is another one of the great mysteries that we'd like to get the answer to. He decided, I'm going to put Jim Roden in the freezer. Now, it could have been because he was lazy and didn't want to go buy a plot of land and bury him. It could have been that he wanted to keep the money that Marjorie gave him to buy a plot of land and just put him in a freezer. It could have been that he was just terrified and thought, I'll take care of it later. But when Marjorie found out that her boyfriend was in the freezer and hadn't been taken care of, she went ballistic, and she badgered him. She went back to his house over and over again. What are we going to do? And then Bill needed to temper her, and he said, oh, well, let's go. We're going to grind him up. Let's go get a meat grinder. And they actually went and shopped for a meat grinder, a commercial meat grinder.
What?
And this is another crazy story that and they couldn't find an ice crusher.
La Folie à deux.
So, exactly. The F-Folie à six in this case.
Yeah,
but
yes.
But they not only went to buy a meat grinder, but they also went to buy an ice crusher, and they couldn't find a one that was large enough. So Marjorie actually went in and bought one for like $70 or something in a general, like a, you know, a store. And they had, Bill had the box in his house for a ice crusher. So he was under great pressure. He thought he was going to be the next guy in the freezer. But what an incredible risk he was taking, because of all people who can't keep their mouth shut, that's Marjorie Dale Armstrong. So if you say, hey, she killed her boyfriend and he's in the freezer, don't you think Marjorie would say, oh, and Bill did the heist? And she didn't say that for the longest time, until she couldn't take it anymore. And that was at her preliminary hearing.
Right. And that's where you come in. Yeah.
And then
yeah.
She continued to do that. I mean, she did that. At first, she mouthed off about Floyd Stockton, you know, where, oh, he's got this, you know, this rapist living with him who's on the lam. And so she mouthed off about him. And then she mouthed off about Bill. And then when she couldn't take it anymore, years later, she started to do the same thing about Ken Barnes. And then now, you know, she did the same thing to me about Jessica. And so it was this, you know, impulsive behavior. She didn't want to be the only fall guy for this crime. And, you know, without her speaking, you know, who knows what would have happened in this case? You know, it could have went cold forever.
It probably would have. And, you know, the very curious thing is how Rothstein thought that it wouldn't splash back on him to say that he had the body in his freezer. I mean, clearly that implicates him in a crime, whether it's disposing of some human remains illegally or whether he was involved in the murder. Something illegal happened for it to result in the body being in his freezer. And so he really, really believed in his own press that he was smart enough to talk his way out of anything. And he damn well nearly did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he had a history with, you know, law enforcement in Erie, and including the DA. And, you know, many people have shared with me that, you know, he was like boys with them and he had helped them on other cases. So, you know, speaking to what, you know, what you're describing, Jim, he definitely had that confidence. That confidence is probably what, you know, made him realize that he could try to pull this off.
Well, and a little deep
by coming forward with the body.
A little deep dive into Bill, he'd actually helped another friend get away with trying to cover up a murder before. It was a guy named Louis Alessi who worked for a newspaper. You tell the story. You know it a little better, I think.
Yeah, well, Louis Alessi's wife was having an affair, and this topic got brought up with Bill, and Bill encouraged this Louis Alessi to take out the man that his wife was having an affair with, and that's exactly what happened. And then Bill disposed of the murder weapon, of the gun.
Oh, of the weapon.
But when he thought that people were getting close, he went to the police and said, my friend used this gun to have his wife. He turned his friend in, and he didn't get charged.
And he got off.
Yep. So he was successful, right?
Okay.
And then he's kind of pulling the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why I think Bill.
The frozen body.
I mean, for me, I had my eye on Bill, particularly from that interview where he said he wants to be known as the smartest guy in the room, right, Jim? We both reacted at that point when we heard him say that.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that. I mean, this type of narcissism, I mean, comes with the fact that you do not credit anybody with anything, that you feel that you are the best, the ultimate authority on everything. And I kind of really doubt that he would have been, quote, really afraid or scared of Marjorie, because I think he thought, you know, she was more of a, you know, an obsession of his rather than something that he really was fearful of. I mean, why do you believe that he was actually literally afraid for his life because of her?
Well, that was how he was telling that, you know, he was controlling the narrative, and that was the narrative he was offering. You know, from the initial 911 call, he's talking about his fear of her. You hear Trooper Ron Morgan say, are you afraid of her? And he said, I am.
Yeah, because he's got the backstory. He knows she's been on trial for the murder of the previous partner in 1984. You see, he knows these things. He knows the Achilles heel, and I call it that. And he projects because he's trying to keep his side of the street clean. That's what he's trying to say. Yep. Don't look at me. Look over here. Look over here. Keep looking over here. And his narcissism and his need for control, for me, was just striking, just the way he held court with the cameras of showing them around the crime scene, you know, where Jim Roden had been in his freezer and he's just talking in this way that I can see he's enjoying it.
Jim, can't somebody also be afraid and obsessed at the same time? You have that sort of, I don't know, codependent relationship with somebody?
Yeah, it could be. But in his, I mean, there's nothing about his behavior, you know, in terms of interacting with her, that indicated he was actually afraid of her. He wasn't trying to separate himself from her. He wasn't trying to, you know, basically build a wall of protection. I mean, he was involving himself more and more deeply. I mean, obviously, if the body got into his freezer before they did this this botched robbery, murder, I mean, he could have gotten away from that, but. You know, he left the body in his freezer and he did the robbery and murder with her. You know, he went out and made the call with her. He did all these things with her right there. It just doesn't, there's no gun to his head.
No, and the suicide note where he says, the first point, claiming the body had nothing to do with Wells and the bank heist. I mean, there's just so many points of leakage.
Yeah, and it's so, right. You know, and by me saying that he was afraid of her or giving up, in the sense that it became, there was too much gravity of the situation for him. I feel like he was in that space, but I agree with everything you're saying in terms of the motivation as of this crime as a swan song of Bill Rothstein. Because, you know, there's so many layers of his manipulation, you know, not only within the co-conspirators, but within, you know, just his lot in life. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, he knew he was going to die
right.
very soon. So this was a game for him. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he got money from Marjorie and, initially because, you know, she had a sack of money, you know, which is how she rolled. She always had large amounts of money on hand. And so when she got Bill to come over to her house to help with Jim Roden's body, he took from her, you know, a sack of around $100,000, and he was controlling that money. What did he do? Behind the scenes, he took that money, divvied it up, and gave it to his best friends and family members. So he knew something was about to happen.
And you said he gave the money to the best friends. He had written another suicide. I always wondered about the veracity of his saying, this is a suicide. Did he really want to commit suicide? But not only did
Fitz
write that.
Could have a look at that note, right? And would be able to tell you, because he's looked at, you know, the study of suicide notes are genuine and authentic and which ones are not.
And there were three other suicide notes. We couldn't get too deep into this, but new information here. And Trey just mentioned it. He sent his friends, three of his friends, he sent them a portion of the money that Marjorie had given him to hide the body. He decided he was going to end his life, and he sent them letters and said, here's this money. It's not hot. You can spend it. Enjoyed being friends with you, and bye. And they're like, wait, is he going to kill himself? So was he really going to kill himself, or was he setting it up to look like he was going to kill himself so he would get some kind of, when he was found out for helping hide this dead body, he would get some kind of a lesser, he'd get misdemeanor charges instead of something worse.
Right.
So, yeah.
And if you can imagine, that money ended up back in Marjorie's possession.
Oh, here's some. Oh, this is the best. Wow. This is the best insider story. This would be in the feature film if it ever happens. But even on, like, towards his deathbed, Bill Rothstein had such an affinity for Marjorie Dale Armstrong. And even after everything she did to him, and she yelled at him and called him names in the press, he made sure that he got that money, because his friends gave the money back to the police. He helped her get that money back, because he sits in this Erie PD interview and he says, I didn't give her she handed me the money. She didn't give me the money. And we were like, why is he being so strategic about that? Well, it turns out legally, if she had given him the money, it would have been his. But if she just handed it to him, it's still technically hers. And she got her money back.
No remorse whatsoever. None. Never one time did she shed a tear for James Roden. They had these, like, tin trays on the wall that were used by the inmates for, like, mirrors. And she would stand there for hours shaving her eyebrows off. You know, just creepy look on her face. For hours she would stand there doing that. Now, I mean, if you're gonna do that, it takes a second, right? She had one face for the guards and a whole nother one she showed us. She was trying to make herself look crazy to the guards. The woman is a master manipulator.
Originally, didn't you think this was going to be 10 episodes, and it turned out to be 4?
Yes.
Can you talk about that, process?
This is how it goes with Netflix. Like, oh, we'd love to do, like, 10 episodes. Well, you know, maybe 4. Okay, we'll do 6. And I had written 6 episodes, and we ended up doing 4. And it ended up being a blessing. Netflix was really, like, their input was invaluable, because they were yet, like, when Trey brought everything to me, it was like he had this whole forest and I had to pick out the trees, and then I take it, you know, we go to Netflix and they're like, so they actually were interactive with us and gave us notes. So we were able to get feedback from them, and 4 ended up being, I think, just the right amount. And I don't know, people have responded and said it's a quick one, you know, it's a quick binge. We felt like we could have done, like, a deep dive into Marjorie Dale Armstrong, more of her character traits and her mental illness, because that was so convoluted and complicated and fascinating. More about Bill Rothstein, Floyd Stockton, the other characters.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the West Memphis 3 and those documentaries they did, I mean, that's a story that keeps on giving. And I think that this story may still have more chapters. And perhaps you will get the opportunity to go deeper into her life and her mental state. And I think, again, those writings should definitely be given to Jim Fitzgerald and any known writings of Marjorie, of Bill Rothstein, of Ken Barnes. I think any of those documents that you can get your hands on, if you can give them to Jim Fitz, he could tell you whether there's indications that they were authors of these notes.
A question for you. We have this new revelation at the end of part four that speaks to the innocence of Brian Wells, which is a pivotal, like, had he truly been innocent, murder charges would have been filed. So we have that new information, as well as the fact that there was more than one attempt to do this bank heist. Is it surprising that law enforcement hasn't reacted to this new information? And we don't know for sure if they have or not. Our sources are telling us they haven't. But do you think that there should have been some kind of a, hey, let's dip back into this now? Because we could get more information out or move the story forward.
Right. Well, I think you should probably just take a note from what Laura and I did in another famous case, which is that we sat down and we wrote a letter to the district attorney and law enforcement. We put it on paper. We made documentation and we actually sent it to them so that they would have it. If, you know, it being on a TV show and being in the zeitgeist, you know, that might motivate them, but actually putting it on paper and sending it to the attorney general as well, I think those kinds of things can maybe get some action done. If it's on paper and you make an official request as citizens, you may get a response from them and you also may get them to actually do something about the case.
Yes, we did do that with a case. Actually, I do it in every case that, you know, whether it's a TV or whether, it, you know, real life. I mean, this is real life, but you want to be helpful to them and you also want to create your recommendations as part of their case management file, and therefore it is a formal record. And to ask a question about Erie, just not knowing the geography and the murder rate, I mean, it just strikes me, obviously, Robert Panetti was found dead on August the 31st, 2003, Jim Roden, you know, then Brian Wells. I mean, is this an anomaly, people? And you talked about the other case where he had his wife or the partner having an affair and ended up killing him. I mean, what was the murder rate at this time? Is this kind of like an anomaly, or is it like Baltimore where there's, you know, a high murder rate? I mean, what's going on out in Erie?
Well, you know, at the time, I mean, I don't know if they've ever, I mean, there's crime has spiked in Erie, especially in downtown Erie, not necessarily in the locations where some of these individuals lived. But there was a rash of bank robberies in 2003. So that had spiked tremendously that year. The other thing that Erie, you know, like many towns in America, they're dealing with a huge drug epidemic there. So, you know, as far as murder, I mean, I think they just have their fair share of these unusual murders that you hear of. I mean, obviously the Brian Wells thing is totally different. But to my knowledge, they don't have, like, you know, they haven't cornered the market on unique murders. But in 2003, they did have a lot of bank robberies.
It talks to resources. Is this still an open case or is it closed? I mean, some of the cases
closed
Jim
case.
And I have worked on
yeah.
were
mm-hmm.
open
closed.
But not active. And then they became yeah. active when we've pursued the reinvestigation. But, you know, for me, Robert Panetti being found dead one day before his police interview and his behavior before, you know, and after, that would raise questions.
And here's
right?
some more insider information that wasn't in the documentary. One of the co-conspirators claimed that Ken Barnes, one of the other co-conspirators, actually gave Robert Panetti a hot shot, which is a combination of methadone and Xanax, to kill him. So that's another sub-level of weight. So, but to your question, technically this is a closed FBI major case, closed, done, you know, back in 2011. But new charges could still be filed by the state police if they believe that there's new information that warrants filing charges against any of the co-conspirators.
Right. That's why I said you should write the letter also to the attorney general, because they could usurp jurisdiction over this case if it is actually a murder case. And again, Pennsylvania happens to be an anomaly because it's still a common law state. So it does have some differences in law. And it may not deal with felony murder in the same way that other states do. But the fact is that if someone dies in the course of the commission of a felony, that is a murder, and it's a murder committed by anybody involved in that underlying felony. And I think just on that alone, that the other people should have been charged in this case. And the one guy, I think one guy, maybe two people who still survive, you know, should probably be charged, because murder has no statute of limitation.
Yeah. And if you, I mean, for Floyd Stockton, did you ever interview him? And second to that, if you could ask him any question, what would it be?
Oh, that's, yeah, I have about 20 for him on my, a document right in front of me, my computer, if we ever get him to talk to him. But we did try, we had to locate him. We found him. We hired a private investigator and we found him. And got a few questions vaguely answered, but he did not want to talk. And then he did talk. I did talk to him and his wife at the time on the phone for a little bit. And they seemed like they would talk with us. But then we got a call from his attorney. And apparently Floyd Stockton still owes his attorney money, and they wanted $100,000, at which point I said, I've never paid for an interview in my career. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a journalist, ethical journalist. So we do know that he's divorced now and living up in Washington.
You bring that up about being a journalist. That was a question I wanted to ask you about, you know, how your background in investigative journalism, how did that help you in this? Like, what skills does that bring to being a producer of a
And you probably know something of this because you have the same instincts of, you know, organizing and getting with your job because you're so good at that. But no, when Trey brought everything to me, it was a lot. And so it was like, let's keep track of things. Let's make a plan. Here's our checklist. Mm-hmm. We have to go to read this and do this and do that. And it was just corralling all the information and spending hours going through it. And this is something somebody taught me this once, and it's the best advice I ever got. And I'm obsessed with going through every single frame of videotape that you get and writing, going through all the phone calls that he made with Marjorie, because you never know, and all the paperwork, because you never know when you're going to find the gems. Which I found one where, I mean, you knew about it, but when Marjorie's talking to Trey, how the way she flipped her personality so quickly, and she would say, as you saw in the documentary, on the one hand, she'd say, I'm going to sue your effing balls off. And then in the next conversation, it's, love you, Trey. And finding little gems like that that just explain her character in a word, like a couple of words, love you, Trey. It's like, does she think she could say that to Trey? Like, she thinks that's that kind of a relationship. But
how would you respond to that, Trey, like when she said those things?
Oh, I would just kind of say, oh, well, you know, bye.
He never said love you back. I checked all his phone calls. He never said it back.
You know, I mean, clearly she knew that I felt for her, and we had a friendship, and I was, you know, obviously as compassionate for her as I could be. Mm-hmm. And that was just part of, you know, part of our relationship. I mean, you know, because of my job in doing this documentary, you know, I also had to bounce back, you know, no matter how rough our conversations were. You know, when she would call, you know, I would have to bounce back because, you know, you just wanted to hear, you wanted to document, you know, how this was going to end. And
so when she died, what happened for you? Because obviously you've had this long, complicated and complex relationship. She's been in your life and, you know, it was pretty intrusive in your life.
Oh, yeah.
And so what happens for you when she died?
Well, you know, there was, you know, relief in a couple of different levels. One was she was suffering greatly. I mean, she did die a horrific death. She had lost her eyesight. She lost her hearing due to prolonged chemotherapy. And she was, in essence, you know, living in prison, you know, with no eyesight or no hearing. And she was horrified. And so in our, you know, last round of conversations and our last visit, you know, I mean, there were days where she would be moved into different parts of the prison and wouldn't know where she was. So she was truly horrified and was dying, and it was a gruesome scenario for her. Mm-hmm. So, but once she did pass and the phone calls were over, you know, I had a lot more time on my hands to, you know, get back to other things.
And your family were no doubt relieved, were they, that the phone's not constantly ringing or you're not being harangued the whole time?
Yeah. And just, you know, that, you know, you drop everything to go and walk into a room for 15 or 20 minutes.
Just in case she might tell you something.
Yeah. And you wouldn't believe, I mean, people in prison, you know, can speak on the phone probably more than anyone else in society right now, unless you're doing it for your, you know, for work, obviously.
But I would tell her, you don't understand, you know, you're calling 8 times a day. You know, I haven't spoken to someone, I don't speak to anybody like the way that I speak with you, you know, and that wasn't enough for her. You know, once we were, you know, down the path for years, you know, it was, she just had that desire to speak with me because she didn't have anyone else.
Right.
You know, that was another challenge in this documentary, you know, was, you know, Marjorie, there is no one, you know, other than her. She has a great friend named Susan, who you see in the piece,
right.
But
yes.
Outside of Susan, you know, there was really no one else, no other friends or family that would speak to her and their relationship with her.
Mm-hmm. An interesting little factoid that's not in the documentary, even after Marjorie's death, she still has a guy who's obsessed with her. Was he a legal assistant or something? And he talked with Marjorie, and he says she is his common-law wife, and he's trying to get her body moved, because she's in an unmarked grave now, close to the facility where she was at in Texas. Medical facility, and he wants her body moved to be close to him. So even, like, this is a woman who has mesmerized, manipulated,
beyond the graves, she's still...
Yeah, I think what's amazing, and you know, I just want to add, Trey, that you just described, you know, a horrific death, and she was a human being, and whether she was an evil genius or just really messed up, it doesn't matter. That's a horrible thing, and it's sad that she went through all that. But the fact is that there are people who only look at other human beings as things to manipulate. And I don't know if she was a psychopath. I don't know if Bill Rothstein was a psychopath. I don't know if Brian Wells was a total dupe in all of this. But, you know, this is Erie, Pennsylvania is a very, it's a small town. It's not like a massive city, and there's not a million things like this going on all the time. And this was a major thing for this town. And to have the the FBI get involved, and to, I have to say, it screw up so royally, and then to have this go unresolved, and basically nobody got justice here. I mean, nobody. And it's just, it's a really sad, sad commentary on how things can go wrong.
Before we wrap up, I have the inevitable question. Actually, I'm casting a horror movie right now in Erie, Pennsylvania.
No.
It takes place in Erie. It's made by Erie filmmakers.
Oh,
it's
wow.
We're casting it, you know, out of LA talent, but everybody's going to have to fly to Erie to do this very interesting horror movie. But anyway, so do you think there's going to be a movie or miniseries? I mean, I think it's a slam dunk that the answer is yes, but have you been approached to do that?
Yeah, there's a lot of material, a lot of rich material here, so we'd love to see that happen. Yeah.
Well, I do have casting ideas.
Let's hear.
Well, so, you know, for Marjorie, there's a number of great actresses. I would put Kathy Bates, Margot Martindale, Susan Sarandon right now is my top choice, Susie Kurtz or Allison Janney. And for Bill Rothstein, I would go, bear with me, Brad Garrett, if you know who that is, Tom Hanks, Stephen Carell, I know that's kind of out there, or Dan Aykroyd. And my only choice for Brian Wells, the only person who can play this, Bill Macy. William Macy.
Wow.
Anyway, you got that for free, okay? There you go.
You know, Erie is where they have the film festival. It's a horror film.
Wow.
You're right. But as a child, I lived in Tiffin, Ohio. And we would go in the summers, we would go to New York and we would drive and we would stop in Erie and go to Presque Isle, which is a beautiful island, and stay on the lakefront. So I only had good experiences of Erie. And then I meet Trey. It's like, there's a whole other side of Erie.
Okay. Right. Anything else, Lady Laura?
Well, I mean, I did have one last question, which was really what you thought the biggest challenge was in putting this together. I mean, the behind the scenes, what was the biggest challenge?
It was an unwieldy amount of information, and it was winnowing it down and staying on a path, on a train track. And it was so easy. Trey and I would often say to each other, are you in the rabbit hole? Yeah, we went down the rabbit hole. Let's come back up. So we really had to focus on that because it is so easy. There are so many shiny objects like, oh, another dead body. Let's go there. Oh, this person here. So it was corralling everything and keeping it so that we could get to the end make it hopefully a fascinating watch for the viewer.
Well, you did.
You did make it a fascinating watch, and you also made this a fascinating set of podcasts. We really, really appreciate you coming on, Barbara and Trey. We hope to continue to talk to you if you do happen to drill down one of those rabbit holes and find more information.
Yeah, thanks, oh, you guys.
Thank you. We love this podcast, you guys. You're awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. Love you. And thank you for coming to this very hot studio and spending time with us.
So. It's our favorite topic. We'll talk about this as long as we can until it's solved, really solved.
Okay,
it was a total pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
All right. Well, thank you for coming, Barbara and Trey. And thank you to our listeners. Until next time, thanks for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.